Join culture creator Ramel Wallace, museum CEO Micah Parzon, philanthropist Erwin Jacobs, and urban agriculturist Diane Moss on Season 2 of Stop and Talk, a podcast about the future of the San Diego region. How can we create a vibrant region that celebrates our cultural richness and economic strength? Find out and hear other San Diego experts on Stop and Talk. Discover seasons 1 and 2 now at stopandtalkpodcast.com. That's stopandtalkpodcast.com. Are you passionate about resolving conflicts and making positive impact in the world? Then USD's Conflict Management and Resolution Master's Program may be for you. Learn to address conflicts at all levels, from personal disputes to global crises. Join the Kroc School's dedicated community fostering peace and understanding while you acquire practical skills to navigate diverse settings. Apply now and be the change you want to see in the world. Visit sandiego.edu/peace/VOSD. That's sandiego.edu/peace/VOSD. This podcast is brought to you in part by the estate of Bob Nelson. Bob was a lover of all things San Diego and a longtime supporter of Voice of San Diego and its podcasts. We at Voice of San Diego are honored to have his support during his lifetime and continued support through his estate planning.
Don't practice any type of game underneath a eucalyptus tree.
Okay.
I was barbecuing for the softball league one time. Yeah, I'm going to keep going for a minute. You can edit it later. I was barbecuing. I was in charge of the grill, and I hear this whoomph behind me, and I look back, and there's a eucalyptus limb. They're coming for me. Welcome to the Voice of San Diego podcast in partnership with News Radio 600 KOGO. I am Scott Lewis, the CEO and editor in chief at Voice of San Diego, and I'm joined, as always, by the managing editor, Andrea Lopez Villafana. What's up, Lopez?
Hey, Lewis. Good to have you back in the studio.
I'm glad to be back. And of course, reporter Jacob McQuinney joins us. What's up, Jacob?
Nothing much.
Coming up on the show this week, Hassan Akrada is out, or will be in a few months. The controversial leader of the San Diego Association of Governments announced his resignation. It's not a surprise to all of you who dedicate your time to listen to this show every week, but it's still worth digesting. And with the special election for the Board of Supervisors coming up, the campaigns are amping up. There's tons of money coming in on both sides, including attack ads on the most high-profile candidate, Monica Montgomery Stepp. Andrea checked the claim in one of those attack ads, and we'll break it down. And finally, we are 1 week into the new ban on camping in public spaces in San Diego, which was already illegal, but now it is more illegal. Reporter Lisa Halverstadt will join us to share what she learned as the city cracks down on tents. Plus, she'll explain why the city is at odds with the region's largest provider of homeless services, Father Joe's Villages. That's all coming up. Stay with us. Okay, before we go on, I do need to explain something. I tweeted this week that Kate Sessions was a terrorist.
Bold claim.
And I like saw it in passing. I was like, I'm just going to like it and not interact much with it. And
you think that's why she set up that park with the vantage point of all of like PB?
Just to be clear, I know she's beloved, the mother of Balboa Park. I know that I'm not trying to cancel Kate Sessions. It was in reaction, though, to this story.
UC San Diego is taking down about 250 eucalyptus trees in the Mesa Apartments neighborhood that school officials say could pose a safety risk if they fall.
So that was just the latest. That was from NBC San Diego. The latest of many news stories that come out every year about the eucalyptus tree. Now, Kate Sessions did not bring the eucalyptus tree to California. That was before her. But she did bring the eucalyptus tree to a lot of places in San Diego, including Balboa Park. You might remember in January, an 80-foot eucalyptus tree fell on a woman and they had to shut down the park. Remember, they closed everything because they were afraid the eucalyptus trees were going to fall. It was a big storm.
Oh, God.
The eucalyptus trees are themselves terrorists. They are horrible things. And So I feel like I need to explain this. Like, one day I was out coaching softball at Robb Field, and there was a... Yeah, I bring up softball a lot. It's a big part of my life.
I'm just drinking water.
You're not just drinking water. I see what you're doing. And there was not too far from where we were practicing, a giant eucalyptus tree branch just fell. Hmm. Now, nobody was there. Nobody got hurt. It's nothing, no big deal.
Yeah.
But if they had been running past that at that point, something could have happened. And those hurt. There, and I think this started for me, I think, about...
Sounds like you were getting really angry over a hypothetical with this tree branch at Robb Park.
Okay, but it's not just hypothetical. That's 7 years ago.
Oh my God, Scott, your reply to your own tweet is wild.
Can you read it for us, Andrea?
It says, quote, "I don't think she intended to cause so much suffering, death, destruction, and privatization of public land, but she did."
Okay. So
you're talking about her as if she's like a bubonic plague ridden like rat in Europe.
I'm crying.
Let's dial back. So 7 years ago, this is where it first started for me. Mm-hmm. Two reporters at 10 News, Marie Cornell and Mike Gold, her photographer, were out reporting on a storm. And a tree branch, a eucalyptus tree branch, fell on them. Whoa. Now, for Marie, it was like life-altering. Like it took her years to recover. She had like PTSD from the experience. It was a really bad. She's only now really back into things.
Wow.
This always happens. These trees are horrible trees. They start on fire all the time. And it's not just because they're flammable, but they leave so much crap on the ground that mm-hmm. is really flammable that they go nuts. Like with a big fire that raced through Scripps Ranch, it was all eucalyptus driven. They're horrible trees. And every year we have to close down Balboa Park or worry about people getting crushed by these trees because they fall over during storms so easy. Now they're meant whenever they have like trouble getting water or drought. Are facing drought, they drop their limbs. They do that on purpose. Well, it's not like they're planning. They're not sentient.
Or are they?
They're just waiting till an unsuspecting softball player walks underneath.
But they drop their trees on purpose. Their leaves on their limbs.
Branches.
So
see, I can't even breathe. I'm so mad.
So
well,
if
I just realized there's one over by ADU over my house.
Oh yeah,
there's one like right above me.
Yeah,
and the dog's bringing these little leaves all the time. Mm. They get stuck on their paws.
They will. It will get you.
Yeah.
So I'm curious if we had like a nice wild population of koala bears, would that help anything?
Sure. I mean, there would be somebody who valued it.
Okay.
But now we have to go every time. Now they're at UCSD. They're going to take 250 of them down. And it's going to take decades for the canopy to ever recover mm-hmm. with something safer, right? It's sad. They start on fire. They kill people every year. In July, a guy died in El Cajon when a branch fell on him. It happens all the time. They're terrible trees. And I want everybody, every time you see one, to look at it with hate. and to know that people brought these here. They weren't here.
Between your jihad against like eucalyptus trees and palm trees,
right.
You have X'd out like 2/3 of San Diego's current like trees.
It's yeah,
which
and
one
Kate's,
do you hate more?
Well, the eucalyptus is more dangerous, okay. But the palm trees are. Every year, some poor guy trying to trim a palm tree gets crushed by them, and because they do it improperly, they should never like climb up underneath them. Mm-hmm. They should always go in through like a cherry picker or whatever. They can't, but every time they always do it, they go up underneath that canopy and it comes in and crushes them. And it happens every year, every single year it happens. And we always say like, and there's a whole like public interest campaign by the state to like tell people like, don't do that. And they always do it. Palm trees start on fire so easily. And she, Kate Sessions, went to Mexico to find those tall palm trees and bring them back here.
Wait, so she brought both of these
yes.
things? Wow, you really hate this woman, don't you?
And, no, I understand she was the mother of Balboa Park. She's beloved. She's there's a Kate Sessions Park is
really
a special
place. Yeah,
but
that's like kind of the thing you say when you're conceding 1 point, but also just trying to like tarnish her name into.
I think we should think about her legacy a little bit. And then the privatization of public land. She leased a big portion of Balboa Park as a private nursery. Now, the deal with the city was that she would plant all these trees in Balboa Park as an exchange for her being able to run this business out of Balboa Park. Mm-hmm. And she planted eucalyptus trees. And so, like, I'm glad that you got to run your business and you got to be known as this, like, very special person for San Diego. But we're still dealing with what you wrought.
Hmm.
Wow.
We need a tree convention in San Diego.
We should lead it.
All the arborists and all of the public officials need to get together and decide like how we're going to phase. Now, she also brought the jacaranda and everybody came at me and like, oh, the jacaranda is really pretty. Okay. They're okay. But they leave a big mess.
They're very messy. We have one right next to our place.
It's like a paste. Have you ever like left your car under a jacaranda for a week? And then come back. It's like your car is ruined.
You're really like opening my mind to a lot of things. I now am going to be walking around this city just terrified at all times of the terrors that and threats that exist all around me.
But you don't already?
I didn't previously.
And I think everybody needs to know that like if you have one, get rid of it. Don't plant one. And let's over time move on to better canopy. About 6 months ago, we had Hassan Akrada, the CEO of the San Diego Association of Governments, the lead regional transportation and planning agency. And of course, he's been very controversial in that role. And we had him here to talk about his future and how long he would last. And here's my exchange with him then. Let's just be direct. Yeah. We talked about the plan approved last year.
Mm-hmm.
Next year, December 2023, mm-hmm. will you be the executive director of San Diego?
I hope so. I want that. Mm-hmm. But again, I'm not going to lose sleep over that. Whether I'm here or not, it's really irrelevant to the discussion. Mm-hmm. What's relevant is this region serious about providing a different ideas for the future?
Do you think it is?
No, not yet. But maybe with time it will be.
Spoiler alert, December 2023, he will be the CEO for barely a day, and then he's out.
Wow.
So, again, you should listen to this podcast if you want to know what's going to happen.
So we predict stuff.
Just San Diego Public Affairs. So, yes, the news this week was that Hassan Akrada has announced his resignation. And there's a lot of that to digest. Now, a lot of conservatives were like, woohoo, got rid of that guy. It was a little muted in the middle, like the Todd Glorias and stuff. Did Todd even say anything? And then, but then there were some of the progressives who were like, oh, we lost this champion of, you know, dealing with climate change and all that stuff, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm going to put out there that I don't think anybody won out of this, like either side. The conservatives aren't going to get somebody who's like, yeah, let's build some highways.
You mean Laura Laffian isn't going to become the new Sandag chair?
No, mm-hmm. no. And the progressives are never going to have anybody like this again.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So let's get into what was interesting. That time we were talking about the plan that they had put in place for the next 40 years about how we will move around the region and the new light rail and heavy rail that they would try to build, the new highways and other exchanges they would try to build, and all the big things that he wants to build, right? The big downtown depot for all the transportation needs, the connection to the airport, all of those things, right? Mm-hmm. That's what the agency's job is to do. And to pull all of those things off, they needed four things to happen in particular. Mm-hmm. Three of them were tax increases. And one of them was a fee that he had proposed and that the board had accepted for months to charge people for driving. We have all of these electric cars coming onto the roads. They don't pay the gas tax in order to pay for roads going forward. They're going to need a different way to do that. Mm-hmm. And so they proposed this mileage fee. Now, how they would collect it, nobody knows. And there was a lot of controversy about it. And then, but the other reason for doing it, they wanted to discourage people from driving, create a, you know, you charge people for it. That has a negative incentive. You don't want to do it. Mm-hmm. You tax cigarettes because you don't want people to smoke. Mm-hmm. And then the other idea was that it would bring in money that they could use to build other things, mm-hmm. other transit opportunities, right? That is the what they put forward. Now, that has turned into the probably the single biggest rallying cry of local conservatives, right? Is there a better one?
I can't.
Since the pandemic?
I can't think of any, no. I mean, that it really is crazy how you see that from La Mesa to San Diego to Coronado.
They want to charge you to drive.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
They want to charge you to drive. Yeah.
Not that they.
It's a short, clear message. Though.
Yeah.
You got to give them that.
Yeah. No, as we always talk about, like the normals, the people that don't pay attention as closely as we do, the things that penetrate their world, our surfing pals, the girls you go to brunch with, right? Like, when they hear about things, it's stuff like that that comes through. Oh, they're going to charge me to drive.
Yeah.
So. Just to be clear on that, they pulled that out of the plan, and the whole discussion we had with him was like, could they take that out of the plan and still be realistic about the plan? And the core message, I think, of Hassan Akrata was like, look, you have committed to lowering emissions to a net zero future almost.
You as a board,
you as a region, you as a board, and the state in particular has committed to a future of emitting no more carbon than you're collecting, than you're sort of taking out of the atmosphere, right? Mm-hmm. And in order to do that, you're going to have to really change things. And if you don't want this fee in there, I understand because it's controversial and everybody made him take it out of the plan so they could stop dealing with these attacks. But if you don't do that or something like it, then you are not being realistic about what it'll take to achieve those goals. So it's the thing I harp on all the time. You can be all the aspirations you want. You can talk about it all the time. We're going to be net zero. We're going to have lower carbon emissions. But unless you're willing to do something that's inconvenient like that, mm-hmm. you are not being realistic. And as he said, you're living in a fantasy. Mm-hmm. And so I think in a way, the fantasy won. Now, Hassan is not going to be the CEO of Sandag, not just because he was saying, like, you need to be more realistic about the money and the commitments you've made. He's also not going to be CEO because the board that oversees him doesn't like him. Yeah. That's the main key.
Hmm. What kind of tension has there been between he and the board? Can you go through some of that?
Well, I think that at first, you know, he really did embrace this vision of, like, you should be able to get around San Diego County, as easily without a car as you can with a car.
Yeah.
Now, he's tempered that a lot. I talked to him this week, and he's basically boiled that down to, like, you should have other options. There should never be just one option to get somewhere, because if you get another option, that's going to make everything better. If drivers have at least one option to go somewhere else or use something else, then everybody who drives will have a better experience, that mm-hmm. sort of thing. Or if you should be able to walk someplace easily. You should be able to ride your bike without fearing for your life, that sort of thing. So he's really boiled it down. Because when he started, there was a lot of, like, I think we should do Hyperloop from Escondido to San Ysidro, you know, like, and I've made my impression of what that is.
Don't do it again.
Okay.
I mean, as someone without a car, not the Hyperloop stuff, that's very stupid, but everything else sounds pretty rad.
Yeah, right.
Like, I mean, I would like to be able to hop on the bus and go to the beach, or have a trolley that takes me to the airport, or a trolley that takes me to the beach. I mean,
they're fast.
That's the thing, right? Without four different transfers and, you know, 2.5 hours.
Right. Without a functioning system like that, you require everybody who wants to have a professional life in this community, a life of both leisure, family, and a job, like, you require them to own a car, maintain a car, store a car, fuel a car, yeah. insure a car, yeah. and that's a burden. That's an it's not a tax, but
it really drains the big city energy for sure.
yeah, and so but no, I think I asked him. I'm like, so do you what happened? Like, and he's like, well, they took too long to fire me, basically. But he's also like, well, I refuse to play politics. I refuse to go along with consensus just for consensus, right? Yeah. And I think there's a couple of things. Like, San Diego used to be this place that, like, you wrote about with the San Diego Unified. Like, it used to be, like, all unified votes, like, always unanimous. Always unanimous. Mm-hmm. Conservatives in the rural areas, liberals in the progressive urban areas. And they would always have these unified, unanimous votes. And then they had a big scandal because they were basically lying to everybody about mm-hmm. how things were going.
Yeah.
Yeah, that shakes things up a bit.
Yeah. And so he came in and he's like, look, you've made all these commitments. There's no easy way to do it. You're going to have a ton more transit and you're going to have to do things that are like charge for driving, right? And the conservatives just hated him from the beginning for that. Now, it's worth mentioning that the only reason he's in that role is because of the only Republican mayor of a major city that existed for a long time, which was Mayor Kevin Faulkner. He's the guy who said, no, we're not going to hire somebody from internal staff at Sandag. You are going to hire this man, Hassan Akrata, and he supported him and said, like, I'm into your big ideas, the downtown hub, the connection to the airport, all of, taking remember the idea to take the old, the Spaywar complex and turn it into something that they could work together on? That was his, and Faulkner's like, yeah, let's go.
Go for it.
So, and then they had a ton of problems with that. And then there was one moment I asked him about this where he donated to Tara Lawson-Reamer, who was running for the county supervisor's seat that was held by Kristen Gaspar, the Republican. Mm-hmm. And everybody lost their minds about that because this was, you never see an agency head like that with a bipartisan oversight group like that donate to just one candidate in opposition to somebody who's on your board or represented on your board. Mm-hmm. Like, that was just like, oh, jaw dropping.
Yeah.
Now he'll point out, like, well, I also donated to the Republican Steve Voss, who was running against Joel Anderson. And I asked him, I'm like, why would you do that? Why would you say you're not political and then do that? And he's like, well, they asked me. So I think he was tone deaf about politics, about playing that game.
Yeah.
But when you ask him about that, he's like, well, yeah, but I wasn't interested in playing that game. I was interested in getting big things done. And I did bring in a lot of money. We finished the trolley. We finished the effort or started the effort to get the new Otay Mesa crossing done, all that stuff. But I think, this fight about the mileage fee, about the reality of the climate commitments, that'll be the legacy.
I mean, when you're looking at these big, sticky, complex issues like climate, I think ultimately you kind of need somebody like that who is not interested in playing the politics and who is not interested in taking half measures. I mean, just yesterday or today, I guess, Mac and I published a story about San Diego Unified's net zero climate resolution, which basically says, yes, San Diego Unified promised to become net zero as long as you ignore the 62% of its district emissions that are transportation to and from the district from parents, staff, and students. I mean, that is the kind of thing that it seems like Hassan Akrata would not have approved of, right?
Exactly. So this is the thing with all climate discussions right now, is this whole region, as far as the liberal majority in this region, they love saying, like, we care about climate change. And we love saying, like, oh, we're gonna do all these things to deal with it. The city's climate action plan that Kevin Faulkner, again, took a lot of credit for and thought that he could use to leverage and turn into a bid for governor. Like, that whole effort is all this exercise in being like, we love addressing climate change and setting goals. But the hard things that it'll take to get to those, to massively rehaul the system of transportation. To take people's stoves and natural gas appliances, to otherwise, like, you know, raise the cost of fuel. That's what they want. They to make that possible, you do need gas to cost a lot. But every time that gas or electricity costs a lot, they're like, no. Every single time that it gets hard to accomplish a climate change goal that they have set out, they back away from it.
Yeah.
And Hassan Akrada's entire point to them was stop. Like, you have to deal with that. You can't have both ways. You can't say I'm here, but then when it actually comes to doing something hard, you go away. You freak out. You back off.
Yeah.
And you know what? He lost. He's out, because they want it that way. They want it. The consensus in San Diego is to let it be and to set an aspiration, then back off.
It's kind of like me when, you know, a friend invites me to their show, and then all of a sudden it's 9:30 on a Thursday night, and I'm like, you know, I got to put shoes back on.
Yeah. No, it's the basic, exactly. It's the basic human. I talk about this a lot, and people are sick of hearing me, but it's the human desire to say, like, I want to do this, and I'm going to do this. And then you get the credit, you get the dopamine boost from saying you're going to do that.
Yeah. Well, it's also political expedience, right?
Right. And then when it comes to the actual doing of it, it's easy to say you're going to go on a diet until you're hungry. Like, it's easy to say you're going to run a marathon until you have to run.
Yeah.
Like, it's, and that's the problem. And the hard part is never anything anybody wants to do.
So what happens now?
They'll hire a really boring person whose job it is to bring in money and won't be in the news. That's what they'll do.
Yeah. Well, you know, going along with my desire to see my support of, like, a chaos candidate slate, I would love to see some really off the wall idea. I mean, why not bring in Musk? Let's see what he has to say.
Right? Or ask him who he should bring in.
Yeah.
He's going to change our city logo.
It's just going to be X now. SDX.
Now, that's funny, but that's one of the big ideas that Hassan had, was like, let's see what Elon Musk would do to our transportation system.
Yeah.
And Elon Musk was like, I don't know, Hyperloops. Yeah.
And to be clear, to be clear, I don't think this would be a good thing for San Diego, but I do think it would be funny.
So now let me just be clear. I think one of the main goals right now is to get, there is a sales tax measure, a half-cent sales tax that the unions and other groups are proposing. And as a highlight, they're trying to highlight both all the potholes they're going to fill. Uh-huh. Again, when it comes down to it, it's all about roads and driving and a connection to the airport, right?
Yeah.
And our old friend Andy Keats reported this week that they settled on a route that they want to take from Santa Fe Depot to the airport.
Andy.
Yeah, RIP Andy. He's at Axios, just whatever. So they are trying to, you know, like, they want to raise that sales tax, and having Hassan gone will help that, I think, in their calculation. And they might have, like, said, hey, maybe you could do us a solid and get out of the way.
Interesting.
Now, related to that, there is a mailer going out, several mailers going out from Amy Reichert, the Republican running to replace Nathan Fletcher at the County Board of Supervisors. Again, there's Amy Reichert, the Republican, Janessa Goldbeck, and Monica Montgomery-Stepp are two Democrats running, and Paul McQuigg, another Republican running for that seat.
The name just really does not roll off the tongue.
No. Well, Amy Reichert, who's running for that seat, she sent out a mailer from her own campaign, and she said, Amy will fight the disastrous mileage tax. Amy believes local families deserve to keep more of their hard-earned money. That's underlined. She has a fake bill of what it would cost, $900 per year per person to pay for this. Now, again, they have removed that from the plan. And that plan is being submitted to the state. And I asked him, like, so is the state going to take that? He's like, I hope they do. I don't know if they will. But
wait,
is the state
going to take it off?
So the state has to decide if the plan conforms to the climate commitments.
Mm-hmm.
And without that fee, there's a question about whether it'll discourage driving and fund enough of the changes and rearrange the way people drive enough to correspond to the climate commitment. Now, they can monkey with the numbers so much that it probably will, but he basically said, I hope they will. I hope it will. But that was what we had that whole conversation about, was like, you're just playing the game at that point too, where they get what they want. They can have these aspirations without actually doing the hard work to get there. Mm. Now, that was just one of the many mailers that are going out in that race. There, we have heard from dozens of people about another one where Voices of San Diego is cited. It has Janessa Goldbeck running, and she is running. She's being pitted against, in these mailers, Monica Montgomery Stepp. Now, describe the mailer and what you wanted to look into.
Yeah, so there's two, but I think the one that I was looking at, it has three basic points on it. And one of those point sources are reporting, which, you know, obviously immediately piqued my interest. But it's that Monica Montgomery Stepp supports defunding the police. The bottom line after that is, despite a historic police staffing crisis, City Council member Monica Montgomery Stepp sought to slash the city's police budget.
And there's another version that just says she wants to defund the police.
Yeah, she supported defunding the police department. Mm-hmm. She wants to defund the police. I wanted to check that. I think there's been discussions, you know, I think the individuals who support Monica have said, like, well, no, look at her voting record. She has always voted yes to approve every single city budget that has come before her. And every single city budget has included an increase to police spending.
So, and that's true.
No, she hasn't cut police funds is what their argument is.
And that's a real sign of the political environment that we're in, where it's like, no. No way did she support, quote, defunding the police or anything like it. She has always supported to increase the police budget. And just to have that be like the corrective sort of instinct is just itself an indication of how much things have changed in just 3 years.
Yeah. But then there's like a nuance to that, because every time I think she's brought up these conversations of, and even proposals and asks of, well, let's cut $10 million from the overtime and how can we reallocate funding? And I think after 2020, after the city council approved that budget, which, you know, some of us might remember, but
that's... Well, let's go back to that time.
2020. Ooh. Dark times.
Let's not stay here very long.
So in June, the city council was having discussions about their budget. Now, if you remember, this was around the same time. There was a lot of, unrest and a lot of movement to defund police departments and, Black Lives Matter, defund the police, all associated and all related to the murder of George Floyd in Minneapolis.
Right. So, and again, I remember that time. It is a natural and I think healthy democratic instinct in a society like this to look at an agency that you oversee as the people, and the government is the people, and if you want to hold an agency accountable, doing so through budgetary negotiations or legislation is a natural place and a healthy place to exercise that discussion. Now, especially when it comes to a group of government actors who have the ability to they have a monopoly on violence. They have the ability to kill people if they need to. They have the ability to take people's property if they decide they can. That's a place, their budget is a place to talk about those things. And that's where that expressed. Now, it was pretty raw. It was like a 12-hour meeting that we all remember
when hundreds of people
are zooming in and calling in, and it was a real nightmare. But out of that meeting, they stuck with the budget.
Yeah, they stuck with the budget. Monica's comments during that meeting, I mean, she clearly, you know, feels for these calls for police reform or looking at how we're funding police and whether we can reallocate money from police departments to community and addressing these, you know, really terrible disparities and injustices in communities of color. But, you know, they were already so far along in these budget conversations that there wasn't much that they could do. And so...
Yeah, they had just negotiated new labor contracts with the police union. Mm-hmm. You can't unravel those in a night like that.
Yeah. And so she voted to approve the budget as well as the other council members, and it passed with increased funding.
They did talk about and want to do something after that, right?
Yeah. So she requested that the city's independent budget analyst just look at like what they're spending with police and where everything's going, with the goal of having conversations around reallocating resources. And there was a specific term used there that was not defund the police. Yeah, so the ask was to dig into the police budget and identify, quote, potential reprogramming opportunities.
Yeah, right. She said to us at the time, she said, I want everyone to know that I really do believe that we need to look at the way we provide public safety. I think our officers are charged to do too many things over the long term. We need to look at reallocation and allowing officers to do what they're originally charged to do. There are examples across the nation, but I really want to see what that looks like and have a plan for it. So there was like, give me a plan to cut or otherwise change things, right?
Yeah,
now, the question is that, quote, defund? And the police officers you talked to were like, yeah, of course,
yeah,
that's defund.
She wants to, she's like expressing her intent or her desire to remove money that belongs to our police department and put it somewhere else. So yes, that's defund for them.
And then her response was?
She didn't respond.
That's right. So she was basically like, a record speaks for itself. I voted for all
my
these
votes.
Budgets. You know, I'm not going to. But I think it's clear that, again, something big has changed for her not to say like, yeah, I absolutely wanted to, you know, reallocate or otherwise change how they got funding because I felt like they had gotten out of control and I was responding to the community's concerns about that. To not do that and to instead say like, no, of course we didn't try to cut the police is itself just so indicative of where we're at politics-wise.
Well, we were talking about it earlier, like people who were on the other side who were looking for a champion to cut police spending. How would they take that? I don't know.
Be interesting.
I do have one update. I just received an email from Janessa Goldbeck. Lieutenant Colonel Alex Vindman, key witness in Trump impeachment, endorses Janessa Goldbeck for Board of Supervisors.
What? Vindman, huh?
What?
Yeah. There we go.
So what do you think? Is that going to really turn the tide for Janessa? Is this does she have it in the bag now that Vindman, one of the like?
No, but
endorsement announcements are interesting.
There is something interesting that this also says about the Democratic Party right now, right? Because you have Monica Montgomery Stepp, who, by the way, won her seat in facing tons of opposition from unions in particular.
In 2018.
Right. Now she has so many endorsements and funders on that side from the unions. And so that's changed a lot. And so that represents the kind of track she is on.
Yeah.
Janessa Goldbeck's in that more like neoliberal track of like resistance. She's pretty oriented around social justice issues, LGBTQ, all that sort of world, but also more conservative on actual like public safety and fiscal issues and capitalism in general, mm-hmm. and build homes, you know, out in the country, you know, do stuff, let people make money. And so I think that is a real interesting distinction. And frankly, it reminds me of the guy that she's trying to replace. They're both trying to replace Nathan Fletcher. Nathan Fletcher used to be that sort of middle neoliberal, you know, candidate that got squeezed from the union side and from the Republican side, and lost because of that. And it was only when he finally went to the union side that he was able to start winning election, won the county supervisor race for the first time and then won re-election. And I think like the only difference now, though, is that Janessa Goldbeck's running in that lane and she has kind of a lot of Republican support in that. They're not trying to take her down in the same way. And so she might be able to pull it off, because if she got squeezed in the same way Nathan would, then she wouldn't make it through the runoff. And I think that's a big question. Does she make it through the runoff, or does Amy Riker, the Republican?
Mm-hmm. So what do you think happens if both Monica and Janessa make it through the runoff? And at that point, you have the other race, Tara Lawson Reamer's race.
Yeah.
And what does that mean for spending on the Monica and Janessa race?
It'll be big. I have a little bit of news on that, by the way. Richard Bailey is not running for that seat. So,
That's really.
Can I get a post, thanks, on our website?
Yeah.
Hello.
That's really a blow to my chaos candidate.
Yeah.
You're out platform. Here assigning me stories when you have a story.
I just got it, okay? So that Kevin Faulkner versus Tara Lawson Remer. Now, that'll be next year, so it won't be the same time period. Yeah. But I think that a Janessa Goldbeck versus Monica Montgomery Stepp sort of condensed election, again, those two tracks of the Democratic Party, plus all the Republican and conservative interests that'll come in for Janessa, it's a big fight and a mm-hmm. lot of money with a lot at stake. And it could be, we were worried about the tensions now and the accusations and the feelings of bad faith and such. It's going to get infinitely worse. But, you know, it's good for mailers. We're going to take a quick break. Stay with us.
Join culture creator Remel Wallace, museum CEO Micah Parzon, philanthropist Erwin Jacobs, and urban agriculturist Diane Moss on Season 2 of Stop and Talk, a podcast about the future of the San Diego region. How can we create a vibrant region that celebrates our cultural richness and economic strength? Find out and hear other San Diego experts on Stop and Talk. Discover seasons 1 and 2 now at stopandtalkpodcast.com. That's stopandtalkpodcast.com. Are you passionate about resolving conflicts and making positive impact in the world? Then USD's Conflict Management and Resolution Master's Program may be for you. Learn to address conflicts at all levels, from personal disputes to global crises. Join the Kroc School's dedicated community fostering peace and understanding while you acquire practical skills to navigate diverse settings. Apply now and be the change you want to see in the world. Visit sandiego.edu/peace/VOSD. That's sandiego.edu/peace/VOSD.
So we are trying something a little bit new on the Morning Report. My days, I work with Andrea on Wednesdays to put together a fabulous Morning Report that gets sent out in the wee hours of the next day, Thursdays. And we decided to kind of experiment with this new thing that we're calling Song of the Week. And essentially every Thursday in your Morning Report, you will get a local song that we feel is, you know, something that can help you get through the rest of your week and to the weekend. And this week, this first one, it's the song is called Seahorse by this super talented songwriter, Jackie Mendoza, who grew up both in Chula Vista and Tijuana. And it for me, kind of felt like this beautiful dip in some cool water, which has been a real relief for me as somebody who does not have the money to run a window AC unit and is instead stuck with a box fan running all night and waking up with very dry lips. So I hope you enjoy that song, and please reach out and let me know if there's something that you've been bumping all week. I would love to hear what has been going on in your musical world, and send me a couple sentences as to why you have been digging this song so much. You can reach me at jakob@vosd.org. So that's Jacob with a K at vosd.org.
Cool.
I'm so sorry about your AC.
Well, this week we started, or we at least saw the city begin its enforcement of the camping ban that it passed in San Diego. Now, as we pointed out before, camping was already banned in different ways in the city. The difference now appears to be that they can put up signs, and there's obviously a lot more going on. And to help us understand it, in the studio right now is Lisa Hauerstadt, our reporter. Hello, Lisa.
Hello.
Hey, Lisa.
Thanks for coming in. So we have seen, you've been tracking, there are some new signs appearing. What did the signs say, and what are people experiencing right now on the streets?
Well, so the signs are pretty simple. It's just really a picture of a tent and, you know, X marks the spot, not here, yeah. essentially. So it's not a lot of detail, but they're not huge signs. So you actually have to go looking for them or be in an area to really notice them. And I have spent some time, I've been getting in a lot of extra steps lately trying to find these signs. So most of them I found thus far have been in Balboa Park, but there are a few I spotted on the edge of downtown in Barrio Logan area. You know, there's really been a lot of, I would say, tension on the street about the potential impact of this. There's been a lot of uncertainty. But in the early implementation, it really doesn't seem like it's just an overnight sea change.
Right. So that's the reason I bring up the signs is because as we were trying to understand the actual impact of this ordinance, because, again, they did clarify that it was already illegal to camp on public land in San Diego, that this is kind of what they wanted. They wanted to be able to be clear that actually you really can't camp within two blocks of these special places, schools and whatnot, and everywhere else when there is shelter available, and that the signs were something they really wanted to do. They wanted to be able to say, like, you can't camp here, and empower the police to move people along. That's why I call it the move along ordinance. It felt like it gave them a tool to tell people to move along. And you guys, Will Huntsbury, and you broke the news that there was a big sweep in some areas where there's a lot of encampments, but that was before the actual enforcement was allowed of this camping ban. So it just kind of showed that there was already a lot of that allowed. So we don't know exactly what's changed since then.
Mm-hmm. Well, one note on you know, what happened at, it's around 16th and National area and Commercial. There aren't camps there now. They did clear that out using the encroachment ordinance. What's interesting, though, is that's not really where enforcement of the camping ban has been centered at all to start. What I learned today, we're recording on Thursday at a press conference that Mayor Todd Gloria held, is that the initial enforcement has all been focused on moving people along out of Balboa Park. And obviously, you know, the police are offering shelter. They said that as of or through Wednesday, they had contacted 30 people and that three people were actually arrested for completely unrelated things, warrants. There were two people that were cited for unsafe camping citations. That's what the city is calling the camping ban. And one person accepted a spot at a safe sleeping site. So that's kind of, as it relates to this ordinance, what's been happening in Balboa Park. I think that officers would say the difference is that previously, yes, technically you could tell somebody to move along in Balboa Park with illegal lodging and maybe use encroachment if they were blocking a public right of way. So like if they were in a sidewalk. But now with this ordinance, they're able to say, this is a sensitive zone. You're not allowed to be here. You need to move along. And some activists have been very concerned this week about how that's gone.
Mm. It's still not satisfying to me. Like, I don't understand what's happening. Like, are they, because when the mayor touted his own impact, he put up a tweet showing all these before and after videos of these areas that have been cleared out. But again, they had been cleared out with previous existing laws, right? And I don't understand what is changing or what has changed yet. And that's still been something that I've been grappling with, other than the signs.
Well, I would say, you know, as a reporter, I'm trying to understand this too. Mm-hmm. And it's been difficult to figure out. I mean, the reason I've gotten in so many extra steps the last week or so is because they weren't saying even where these signs were going up. And so I was trying to figure out, I'm like, oh, hey, let's take a walk in the park and see if there's a sign, right? So yeah. They really haven't been talking about it. Today was really the most information we've gotten. Interestingly, you know, as you pointed out, the mayor's office has been showing these videos and photos. And I actually said to somebody at the press conference today in the mayor's office, like, you're contributing to the confusion around this because, you know, you're saying, hey, this, you know, what happened at 16th and National and Commercial had nothing to do with the camping ban. But then here you are at a press conference with B-roll in the back showing that. I will say, too, that what's been interesting is that the mayor has really been emphasizing that there isn't going to be an overnight change with this, that it's going to be gradual. And when I talked to some police officers after the press conference today, too, they were telling me they really want, you know, to focus on Balboa Park and, you know, not really go to other areas just yet until they've really done a lot of work there. And I thought that was interesting, too. you know, and they argued they, you know, wanted to try to really talk to all the folks there, get more people into safe sleep, kind of explain what the new rules are. But obviously there are lots of other areas in town where people, you know, maybe it's their kid's school that has camps nearby or other parks. I think they'd like some attention too.
Mm-hmm. Do you know why they've chosen Balboa Park?
I don't know specifically why. I have to imagine it's because of all the city parks, it's the one that's most impacted by homelessness and closest to downtown. And over the years writing about homelessness, I've known many people who go back and forth between Balboa Park and downtown. Mm. And they also have the two safe sleep locations, one that's open, one that's going to open behind the Navy Hospital. This fall. So I think that's part of it too, is they're so close to this site and there's just so much back and forth between downtown and Balboa Park.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of the safe sleep locations, what is the capacity looking like at the one that has opened?
Great question. So we got an update on that today as well. So as of Wednesday night, 111 people were staying there in 93 tents. Now, you know, listeners may remember that capacity is going to be 136. So there's still, you know, more space for folks to move in. But I did ask the question today, I mean, what happens when that's full? Because so many people have expressed interest in that. I will say, too, that there continues to be confusion about how people get into the safe sleeping site and about how many people want to be in it or if they're on the waiting list. The police have said that everyone that they have wanted to get into safe sleep who's agreed to that, they've been able to get in. But I, you know, had documented that there's a lot of interest in this. And if people want to get in, though, they have to be connected with an outreach worker. They can't just show up. And so they have to get on 2-on-1, which a lot of homeless people will complain about because it's not always a surefire way to get connected with the service.
I feel like there was a video of the mayor saying before the streetlights vote earlier, he had said something like, you just go to one of the safe camping sites.
And you can't just show up.
You cannot just show up. And there have been... And I think sometimes when public officials are just talking quickly, they don't really understand that there are homeless people listening to them, too, and desperately wanting that resource. So there have been some other comments I've heard, too. So any chance I get, I've been trying to explain this because, you know, people could spend their whole day crossing downtown hoping and thinking that they're going to get a spot and then be told that they can't get in. And that, in fact, was happening to some folks early on.
So that's the main lot, the first one that was open and that allowed them to begin the enforcement. There's another one planned. What's the progress on that or the timeline?
So it's all they're saying at this point is this fall. The mayor says that they have been making some progress. Last I checked, they had cleared some of the weeds there that Ariana had gotten some photos of a few months back. But they're not saying exactly when that will open. I will say, when I was out looking for signs Friday of last week, I met a woman, Tamara, who said she just cannot wait for that site to be open. She really wants to go there over 20th and B. And I think there's probably a lot of people that are looking to see what happens with that lot. Because
why would that be?
For one, she said her kids know where she is in Balboa Park. It's very close to where she's been staying in the park. So she can easily come and go and be in touch with her kids. And it's also where her street family is.
Hmm.
I think there's also some interest in the fact that they call it the O lot. Has multiple levels. And so maybe it won't be so many tents cloistered together and there might be different populations sort of spread out. So I've heard, you know, could there be a section for seniors, for example, and maybe some additional providers that would be able to provide support for seniors, for example.
Hmm.
But we'll see. Much to be determined. And it sounds like I need to take a hike down there again.
Hmm. You know, I'm curious, do we have any idea of if this O lot is going to be temporary as this first safe sleeping site seems to be?
That's a good question. I, from what I understand, I believe the city does have more control over the O lot. But I'm not entirely sure about that. I think as with all of these things, the devil's in the details. and so, you know, certainly when it opens, I'll be asking that question.
Got it.
Okay, well, another piece that you worked on this week was about the largest provider of services for homeless individuals in San Diego and a long-storied organization, Father Joe's Villages. has found itself in a bit of a conflict with the city of San Diego, in particular the Housing Commission. You broke that story this week. It was interesting. There's a lot going on, obviously, and a lot of different contracts. What's the story?
So in February, the Housing Commission sent what they call notices to cure for multiple contracts. And I can hear Andrea in my ear saying, what's that mean? basically, they raised a number of issues and said that they needed to be fixed very quickly, or they could risk actually losing those contracts. And so these were for four contracts, three were for shelters, and the fourth one was for a permanent supportive housing contract. And there were a number of issues, as you said. I mean, we're talking about inattention to facility issues at Golden Hall, where they have one of their shelters. We're talking about complaints from clients, disproportionate number of grievances that have been raised at the Golden Hall shelter, some issues with their suspension. So there are two things going on with that. One, that their list of suspensions from their services is longer than other providers, and they
are— Just to be clear, so people who are suspended from their places of shelter.
Shelter or other services like their health center and otherwise— so again, it's a longer list than other providers, and they're disproportionately suspending Black clients. And then there were also more administrative issues, like some issues with reimbursement requests, contract delays, and you know, some issues too with their management of the permanent supportive housing.
Is there a bigger sort of philosophical difference emerging between the city and this provider? Or is it just like at one point in your story, you mentioned that they had asked for significantly more dollars in their budget for one of the contracts. And then the city just said, well, we'll give the contract to somebody else. Is there a bigger divide occurring, or is it just troubles on these specifics?
That's a good question. I think that there are certainly some philosophical differences about how to handle suspensions, for example. And there's been some back and forth, you know, also when it comes to even the reimbursements. This is kind of wonky, but even, you know, the Father Joe's is saying, hey, like the way that you're handling this process doesn't quite work for us. It's kind of fueling these problems that we have. But I do think to the budget point that you made, I think the bottom line here is that they're saying, hey, this is really hard, complicated work that we do, and we need the funding and support to do it. And we also need to, you know, have the ability to make tough calls about what should happen with a client that does something that's inappropriate in their view on site. And that could be something very serious. That could be threatening violence or actually, you know, assaulting someone. Mm-hmm.
There were some pretty shocking anecdotes in this story. I mean, the one that I think stuck out to me the most was this push-up incident. Can you go into that for us?
Yeah. So I spoke with a former employee who at one point was a supervisor at the Golden Hall shelter. And she told me that a lot of the issues that are laid out in these notices are longstanding. And she talked in particular about how staff at the shelter treated clients at the shelter. And she gave this example from back in 2021 when she was working there, where a man in his 60s who had a heart condition was told that he could avoid a write-up for missing bed check. So basically, so folks understand bed check, you know, every day at a certain time, you have to be at your bed. And if you have a certain number of times, three times actually, that you miss bed check, you can lose your bed and be forced to exit. And so in order to avoid a write-up and have that happen, this man was told to do push-ups, and he did. And then—
By someone on staff.
By a staff member at Father Joe's. And he then the next day ended up in the hospital. And the former supervisor said that a couple days later when he returned, he had lost his bed. Somebody else was already, you know, they had already filled that bed. And I will say, you know, she said that she told her supervisor, and then eventually she told the Housing Commission, reported it to them. And the Housing Commission was very concerned once they became aware of it. They actually contacted Father Joe's. They did their own investigation. and they confirmed that this had in fact occurred. And so then they told Father Joe's that they should conduct their own investigation and take action. Ultimately, you know, Father Joe's and an attorney for the Housing Commission came back and said, you know, this is a employee privacy situation, so we can't, you know, share what was actually done here. So I can't at this point, unfortunately, find out, does that person still work at Golden Hall? But yes, I think it was definitely something that stood out in my reporting as well. It's not directly connected to the notice or these processes that are ongoing related to overseeing Father Joe's. But I think it does speak to a feeling that I have heard expressed on the street for a long time about Father Joe's. People just not feeling like their rights are always respected. And often, you know, I felt it was really important to include that because I just find a lot of homeless people feel that they are almost an underclass of people, that when things happen to them, people don't care. Yeah. And so these issues that, you know, they are looking at now related to client grievances, they're not necessarily as egregious as this, but I think it speaks to, you know, issues that obviously need to be very carefully looked at.
Yeah, I think one thing that you and I talked about as, you know, you were reporting the story and editing, like, this organization is so big and it has so many contracts. And in a way, if, you know, if something is going wrong, if you're a city and something is going wrong with whatever provider you've hired to do something, then, you know, you would have the ability to pull a contract and give it to someone else. But in this case, they make up so much of what the city needs.
And how much is that? I mean, approximately how many of the city-funded shelter beds is Father Joe's providing?
So it's about half of the city's total shelter beds and about $13.4 million in contracts.
Yeah. So it speaks to, you know, reliance. And I think the example of the city choosing to give a different nonprofit the contract that Father Joe's Villages was pursuing is interesting, but, you know, there's still like all these other contracts.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think, you know, I want to be clear that, you know, Father Joe's has taken steps and says it's continuing to take steps to try to work on these issues. For example, they hired a facility manager for Golden Hall. They've hired a new property manager. And the Housing Commission says that, you know, it's sticking it out with them. It's trying to work together with Father Joe's on these issues. This is something I'll definitely be continuing to follow and hear, you know, what happens next. But everyone says they're working on it. They want it to work out.
You can follow all of Lisa's reporting on the homelessness crisis and see that Father Joe's story at vosd.org/Lisa. Thanks for listening to the Voice of San Diego podcast, the most popular public affairs podcast recorded in Greater Little Italy in San Diego. We are fueled by donors and subscribers. You can see the membership levels we provide at vosd.org/donate and choose the level that works for you. We need your support if you enjoy the show and the reporting we do. And you can subscribe to our newsletters at vosd.org/newsletters. That's vosd.org/newsletters. Get the morning report at least and start your day right. I'm Scott Lewis, CEO and Editor-in-Chief at Voice San Diego. Andrea Lopez-Villafana is Managing Editor. Jacob McQuinney is a reporter. Nate Johns, our producer. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you next week.